Paramahamsa, Parivrajakacharya. Asatara Satashi Srimad is Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nantakoti Vaishnavind Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar.
October 8th, 2013, in Hilo, Hawaii. Canto 1, Chapter 8, Text 42. Twai me nanyavishaya matir madu pate sakrit ratim udvahatad adha gangevo gamudanvati.
Twai, unto you, may my ananya vishaya, unalloyed, matihi, attention, madhupate, O Lord of Madhu, asakrit, continuously, ratim, attraction, udvahatat, may overflow, ada, directly, Ganga, the Ganges, eva, like, ogam, flows, udanvati, down to the sea. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O Lord of Madhu, as the Ganges forever flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being diverted to anyone else. Purport. Perfection of pure devotional service is attained when all attention is diverted toward the transcendental loving service of the Lord. To cut off the tie of all of our other affections does not mean complete negation of the finer elements like affection for someone else. This is not possible. A living being, whoever he may be, must have this feeling of affection for others because this is a symptom of life. The symptoms of life, such as desire, anger, hankerings, feelings of attraction, etc., cannot be annihilated. Only the objective has to be changed. Desire cannot be negated, but in devotional service, the desire is changed only for the service of the Lord, in place of desire for sense gratification. The so-called affection for family, society, country, etc., consists of different phases of sense gratification. When this desire is changed for the satisfaction of the Lord, it is called devotional service. In the Bhagavad Gita, we can see that it was just to satisfy his own personal desires that Arjuna refused to fight with his brothers and relations. But when he heard the message of the Lord, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, he changed his decision and served the Lord. And for his doing so, he became a famous devotee of the Lord. For it is declared in all the scriptures that Arjuna attained spiritual perfection by devotional service to the Lord in friendship. The fighting was there, the friendship was there, Arjuna was there, and Krishna was there, but Arjuna became a different person by devotional service. Therefore, the prayers of Kunti also indicate the same categorical changes in activities. Srimati Kunti wanted to serve the Lord without diversion, and that was her prayer. This unalloyed devotion is the ultimate goal of life. Our attention is usually diverted to the service of something which is non-godly or not in the program of the Lord. When the program is changed into the service of the Lord, that is to say, when the senses are purified in relation with the service of the Lord, it is called pure, unalloyed devotional service. Srimati Kunti Devi wanted that perfection and prayed for it from the Lord. Her affection for the Pandavas and the Vrishnis is not out of the range of devotional service, because the service of the Lord and the service of the devotees are identical. Sometimes service to the devotees is more valuable than service to the Lord. But here the affection of Kunti Devi for the Pandavas and the Vrishnis was due to family relation. This tie of affection in terms of material relation is the relation of Maya, because the relations of the body or the mind are due to the influence of the external energy. Relations of the soul, established in relation with the Supreme Soul, are factual relations. When Kunti Devi wanted to cut off the family relation, she meant to cut off the relation of the skin. The skin relation is the cause of material bondage, but the relation of the soul is the cause of freedom. This relation of the soul to the soul can be established by a via media of the relation with the Supersoul. Seeing in the darkness is not seeing, but seeing by the light of the sun means to see the sun and everything else which was unseen in the darkness. That is the way of devotional service. Trayi me nanya vishaya matir madupate sakrit ratim udva hatad adha gange vogam udanvati. O Lord of Madhu, as the Ganges forever flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being diverted to anyone else. So here we find one of the most, I think, beautiful, soul-stirring, emotive verses in the Bhagavatam, and a purport that is so deep and broad and full of meaning that just this one purport practically could be one's complete guide for the practice of Krishna consciousness. It's such an amazing purport, even though it's only three paragraphs long. And it's the kind of purport that you really want to read again and again and delve into each sentence. And were we in a different physical situation, indeed we might do that and discuss each sentence and the points Prabhupada's making here in great depth. So in the previous verse, Kunti said, cut my attachment to my kinsman. And now she's saying, but give me attachment, rati. So rati is great attraction. Sometimes the stage of bhava is called rati. Rati is also the name of the wife of Cupid. And rati has a connotation of very sensual, very deep, overwhelming attraction and love. And give me this rati, she says, for you. And give me this attraction for you exclusively. Like the Ganges is, as Prabhupada says in the word for word, udvahatat, is overflowing and is just going without any hindrance, without just continuously, as the Ganges flows to the sea without hindrance. Ahoitukiya pratiyukta, without stopping in time, without stopping for circumstances, whatever. This is the attraction I want. I don't want the material attraction, and I do want this attraction. So this is how prema is defined also in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where Rupa Goswami quotes Bhishma as saying that prema means when all one's feelings of kinship are reposed in the Lord. Like Bhaktivinoda singing Janaka Janani Daita Tanai Prabhu Guru Pati Tuhu Sarvamoy. You are my mother, you are my father, you are my husband, you are my lover, you are my son, you are my guru, you are my master, you are everything. Other songs he says something similar. You're my brother, he'll add. All relationships, you are there. You are everything. There's no one who's anything. So we may think, and we often do think, that what this means is that then I don't care about anybody else. You know, when we hear these two verses, cut off my tie of affection for my family members and let me be only attracted to you, we think, oh, let me become callous. And indeed, there is that purport where Prabhupada uses the word callous in the Bhagavad Gita. He says one should be callous to the death of a dear family member. So we may think we become hardened to our feelings of affection for others, and then we pour all of our affection to Krishna. So that's one possible interpretation of this. But of course, if one does that, if one tries to harden one's heart towards others and simply be attracted to Krishna, one will find some difficulty. And because of this difficulty, one may then say, oh, no, no, that's not the right way. Let me serve God by serving others. Service to man is service to God, kind of thing. And one may say that it's service to the family, it's service to the society, and that way I will serve God. So there's two possible mistakes that one makes, and we see both of these mistakes done in the followers of Srila Prabhupada, in the societies of Vaishnavas. We see both of these mistakes made. That one will read these verses and say, I will harden my heart to my family and friends, to society, friendship, and love, and I'll only be attached to Krishna. I'll be nasty to everybody else and hardened to everyone else. I'll have no affection or empathy with anyone else. And then usually as a result of doing that, one flips to the other side and says, kind of forget about Krishna. I'll just serve the devotees and I'll just I'll just be attached to my family and I'll be attached to other living entities. And that way I'll become attached to Krishna. So both of those are mistakes. The real truth is sort of mysterious. It's actually not that difficult. And Srila Prabhupada gives a hint here in the purport, which he discusses further in his lectures on this verse, about what does this really mean? What would we really do? And I think it's one of the biggest quandaries for persons who are not yet fully Krishna conscious and who want to be, is what do I do with my feelings of affection for my family and my friends? And what do I do with them? Do I become callous toward them? Do I continue as before, but say that's how I'm going to be Krishna conscious? Do I do something else? What is actually the situation here? Of course, most of us find that our feelings of affection for family and friends, society, friendship, and love, is very troublesome. Like, it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada says here that symptoms of life, he said, such as desire, anger, hankerings, feeling of attraction cannot be annihilated. But we generally find that those sort of feelings, when they're on the level of material relationships, are troublesome. Now that we have some feelings of affection for our parents, for the person we marry, for our children, for our brothers and sisters. But generally, these feelings of attraction give us not all the pleasure that we want, and they also give us a lot of pain. So one may be, if one is a little intelligent, one will say all these feelings of attraction and affection for people, they're ultimately the source of pain. Because I never fully get what I want from these relationships. That's not possible. You will not have any mother, father, husband, wife, sister, brother, son, daughter, employer, employee, friend, who will give you everything that you want. And yet they're the source of so much pain. Sometimes they're angry with me, sometimes I'm angry with them. So many things. So let me just give them up. This is the impersonalistic idea. Let me just give them up. Let me become callous. Materialistic people generally flip-flop between this, what we call bhoga-tyaga. Let me try to enjoy society, friendship, and love. Ugh, let me give it up. It's disgusting. It's not giving me what I want. It can't satisfy me. Let me just give it up. I'll be renounced. And then when they're renounced, they feel lonely. They feel empty. You know, at first it's wonderful. First it's like, oh, freedom, ah. Now I don't, like one lady I know divorced her third husband and she got a tattoo. I'm divorced. Now I'm so free. I don't have anybody watching what I'm doing. No, now I can just eat what I want and wake up when I want and clean the house when I want and do whatever I want. I'm free. I can raise the children how I want. And then after a while, she says, oh, but I'm lonely. How can I find somebody else? So this is Bhogatyaga, Bhogatyaga. And then you find somebody else. And then after a while, you say, oh, this is disgusting. So devotees may do the same kind of thing in the name of Krishna consciousness. The same Bhogatyaga. Oh, my family, that family life is so difficult. You know, let me give it up. Let me just dedicate myself to Krishna. And then after a while, you're like, oh, but I'm lonely and I have this desire and that desire. Let me go. Let me go do all my desires in the world and call it Krishna consciousness. Now, this is the flip-flopping. But actually, neither the so-called renunciation, like the impersonalist tries to stay perpetually in that renunciation and become attached to nothing. To become like that Simon and Garfunkel song, I'm a rock, to have no feelings, to cut off all of their... But we can't, Prabhupada says, we can't do that. We can't do that. So if that's our method, then we will go back to this Bhogatyaga, Bhogatyaga. And more I hear devotees say things like, how are you going to learn to love Krishna if you can't love your husband? Or how are you going to learn to love Krishna if you can't love your son? You know, first you have to be able to love the other living entities, and then that will teach you how to love Krishna. So they will say like this, which is really a disguised form of this service to man is service to God kind of thing. There's so many religions in the world where people do charity work as their service to God. There's many sects of renunciates, whether Christian or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever. I don't know if there's Muslim renunciates, and there certainly aren't Jewish renunciates. But in the religion where there are renunciates, they will often do this. There'll be a convent where everybody is a nurse and everybody is a teacher, and they're working to that Mother Teresa in Calcutta. So she's a nun. She's renounced the world. She's renounced family. She doesn't marry. But what is she doing? She's serving the sick and the poor. This is my service to God. So that's the other mistake. One mistake, the other mistake. One mistake is that if I want to be spiritual, I become hardened and calloused and rock-like. And the other mistake is if I want to be spiritual, I be a materialist, but I call it spiritual. I say, this is my actual spirituality is materialism. I stop any effort to connect directly with God, and I just do charity work in the world or try to be a good person in the world and say that is my service. So what is the real solution? Because neither of those satisfy us. They just don't. Prabhupada's saying here that trying to be a rock, complete negation. And he calls it the finer elements. Prabhupada says we don't want complete negation of the finer elements like affection for someone else. He says it's not possible. And he says a living being, whoever he may be, must have this feeling of affection for others because this is a symptom of life. So this means even in the smallest, most inconsequential body, we will find that the living entity is still demonstrating affection. Like Prabhupada says, there's affection even among the tigers. There's affection even among the rodents and the, lizards and like that. There's some feeling of affection. And Prabhupada says not only affection, but desire, he says even anger. Hankerings. I would like this, I would like that. I mean, that's interesting, because Krishna says, Asochatina Kanchati, don't have any hankerings, don't have any lamentings. But Prabhupada says they cannot be annihilated. So if one tries just simply to annihilate them, I won't have any hankering, I won't have any lamentation. And Prabhupada says desire and anger. I mean, it's fascinating, because Krishna is telling us that desire, fear, and anger are the whole source of our entanglement. Hankering and lamenting are all of our entanglement. And then here, Prabhupada's saying, but they can't be annihilated. So therefore, if we think that Krishna consciousness, if we think it is something like impersonalism, like Gyan, this would really be Gyan-covered bhakti, if we think that Krishna consciousness is something like impersonalism, I won't have any anger, I won't have any hankering, I won't have any affection for anyone. I'll just annihilate all these finer things in myself and become nothing. Nirvisesha Sunyavadi. That will not work. In fact, that is the religion of the demons. The ultimate destination of the demon is to be killed by Krishna and merge into the Brahman. And the demons preach this impersonal religion, that ultimately we're all one and we merge into the light and so forth and so on. And we find that in the modern age, especially, people were interested in sattva-gun or the mode of goodness. They're very attracted to this impersonal religion. You know, just to merge and become nothing, not have any attraction for anything, not have any hankering. But it doesn't stay. They will fall down. Avasuddha buddhiya, one's intelligence is not yet purified. These things are not symptoms of illusion, they are symptoms, Prabhupada says here, of life. And then the other is really karma. That let me be a good person in the world, let me be a pious person, let me give to others. And that tends to be very much in the mode of passion. Let me be known for my good works. It can also be in the mode of goodness. A person in the mode of goodness thinks, you know, let me just be kind and forgiving and compassionate and charitable and have all these finer sentiments so that I'll achieve God. And the person in the mode of passion thinks, let me be like that so that I'll achieve name and fame. But this also doesn't satisfy, because if the object of our worship, if the object of our affection is another jiva, that jiva doesn't have the capacity to satisfy us. Just like the battery in your mobile phone or in your computer doesn't have the capacity to provide all the energy for your home or a city. It is very small capacity. So a jiva has a very small capacity. So that doesn't satisfy us, and we become angry and we become frustrated. So neither jnana kanda or karma kanda, not to be covered with jnana or karma. So what is the alternative? The alternative is rather, again, mysterious. And Prabhupada gives the example here of Arjuna. He said that Arjuna wanted to satisfy his own personal desires by refusing to fight. And he said that once he became Krishna conscious, it was the same Arjuna. The external situation didn't change. He said the fighting was there, the friendship was there, Arjuna was there, Krishna was there, but Arjuna became a different person by devotional service. And Prabhupada, in speaking on this verse, talks about how the spiritual master and the fly are both sitting on the same seat. They're in the same physical location, but the pure devotee is experiencing that he's in the spiritual world, and the fly is experiencing that he's in the material world. So it's not that the location matters, and it's not that the situation matters. Of course, to some extent, one can say if you're in the Dham, if you're in a Tirtha, that has an effect. And one can say that one cannot be performing sinful activities like illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling. But in generally speaking, with some exceptions, the place doesn't matter and the activity doesn't matter. It's not the activity or the place that determines whether you're spiritual or whether you're material. It's one's consciousness, one's motive. And that also is what determines whether our relationships are spiritual or material. And that's what's being described in the last paragraph. Again, this is a very astonishing and deep paragraph, and I cannot claim that I've gone more than a few inches into its surface. I would say that this paragraph, this last paragraph of this purport is so deep and so full of layers of meaning that as one progresses in Krishna consciousness, more and more and more will be revealed. I mean, one can say that of anything in the scripture, but this paragraph is particularly astonishing and can be understood on so many levels of consciousness. So it's not that Kunti, after saying this prayer, is going to walk away from her sons, the Pandavas. That's not what it means. You know, her external dealings are not going to be different But her consciousness is going to be different. That's what she wants. She wants a different mentality. So what are the differences in mentality? We'll find that this bhoga tyaga, this I want to become callous and I want my satisfaction through my relationships of the world, are both predicated on personal desires. I have my desires. Prabhupada used the word hankerings. I have my hankerings. I have things that I want for me. I want to buy these things. I want to have this thing. I want to improve this thing. I want to get rid of this thing. I want people to treat me in a certain way. I want a certain kind of relationships. I want people not to treat me in a certain way. I want the weather to be a certain way, just like here I am in Hawaii. Why do people want to come to Hawaii? Because the weather's nice all year long. It's never too hot and it's never too cold. Practically speaking, you know, I mean, certain places on the island, if you go up on the mountain, are cold, but in most of the inhabited areas of the island, nobody owns an air conditioner or a heater. In fact, in my little room here, I'm usually comfortable even without a fan. And everything's always beautiful, and there's always fruit on the trees and flowers on the trees all year. So that's what we want. We have some desire from Adiatmik, Adidaivik, and Adibhautik. We have hankerings. I want this kind of climate. I want these kind of things from nature. I want this kind of food. I want these sort of relationships. And then I want my body and mind to be a particular way. Why? Because I'm thinking that if I have these things, then I will achieve the fulfillment of my desires. Then I will become complete. Then all of my needs will be met. And I will be happy. I will be happy. So that is a material desire. And it is a desire that puts us at the center. That nature, things, people, relationships are all meant to serve me. And when they serve me in the way that I want, then I'm happy and I feel affection. And when they don't serve me in the way that I want, I'm unhappy and I feel anger and disgust. And that is the essence of material desire. So, you know, if my boss treats me the way that I like, he gives me as much money as I want, he engages me in the kind of work that I want to do, he treats me with respect, then I like my boss. Then I'm happy to have some affection from my boss. And if my boss ignores me, if he doesn't even notice that I'm the one who did all the work on the project, if he claims credit for my work, you know, if he insults me in front of the other employees, whatever, then I feel hatred. So this means that my... my relationship with him is on the basis of my personal desires with myself at the center. So that's material life, and that is illusion. It's illusion because I'm not the center. I'm not the center of anything. I'm not the center of anything. I'm not the center of my family. It's not that everybody in my family is thinking about pleasing me. Which the evidence of which we get many times a day, that most members of our family they're not even aware of what we do, not even thinking about what we do, what to speak of just thinking of pleasing us. I'm not the center of my family. Even if it's a very loving, kind, and affectionate family, still, I'm not the center. I'm not the center of my community. Especially nowadays, you know, most people who live on the same street as me don't even know that I exist. What to speak of having my happiness as their main interest in life. I'm not the center of the company that I work for. Again, you know, most people are hardly aware of what I do and they hardly care about what I do. I'm not the center of my city. I'm not the center of my country. You know, even the president of the country. And if we think honestly, whoever is the president or prime minister or head of state of the country in which we live, do we think about that person's happiness? How much do we sit around thinking about whether or not that person is happy? How much do we try to please that person? Does anybody give even 1 or 2 minutes of their day to thinking, how can I make the head of my country happy? Probably not. So they're not the center either. In fact, probably if we think about them, it's just to be critical. Oh, am I the center of the Earth planet? Or even, is my family the center? Is my family the center of the universe? Is my country the center? Is my planet the center? So if I am working as if I am the center, it's actually madness. It's just complete madness. No wonder I'm not satisfied. How can I be satisfied if I think that I am the center? Here, Kunji's giving the example of the Ganges flowing to the sea. Here on Hawaii, of course, each island was surrounded by the sea, and there's mountains. Each island is made up of volcanoes, and the water falls on the mountains, and it flows to the sea. It doesn't flow to me. It flows to the ocean. It flows to its source. If I'm thinking all the rivers should flow to me, that's madness. Everything should be given to me. I'm the ocean. So therefore we're unhappy because it's just not real. It's illusion. Wait a minute. You all should be thinking about me. You all should be serving me. You all should be helping me. Nature should serve me. When I want to go on a picnic, there should be a beautiful sunny day. You know, the weather is all about me. How everybody treats me is all about me. How my body and mind act is all about me. But it's not. It's just not. At all. In any way, shape, or form. And when we think like that, that is material consciousness. And all of our relationships based on that consciousness need to be cut. This is my wife whose job is to satisfy my senses. That must be cut, has to be cut. This is my son whose job is to satisfy my desires. That has to be cut. Must be. Prabhupada said, if you try to maintain these sort of material relationships and be Krishna conscious, you'll not succeed like pouring water on a fire while trying to light it. You know, I'm going to be a devotee of Krishna. I'm going to give everything to Krishna. I'm going to dedicate everything to Krishna. At the same time, I want everyone to satisfy me and everything to satisfy me and my desires. It's just not possible. Prabhupada gives the example that if a woman has another lover besides her husband, she can't have her affection for both. Her affection will go to the secret lover. Now, just like the concept in a country of being a traitor, which I think is a fascinating concept, by the way. You know, the country of which you're a citizen, you're expected to be loyal to that country. If you want to be loyal to another country, you have to change your citizenship. You can't keep your citizenship in one country and serve the interests of an enemy country. In most countries, that crime is still punishable by death. It's considered a very serious crime. The country that maintains you, to whom you owe your allegiance, and to who you superficially give your allegiance, but then you serve the enemy. You become a traitor. So it's an understanding. You can't do both. You know, you can't be a citizen of Jordan and Israel at the same time. Because they're at war, you'll have conflicting interests and you'll side with one or the other. So you can't say, I'm going to put Krishna at the center. I'm going to have everything flow to Krishna. But I want everything to flow to me. And really, when we talk about affection for family members, it's not that our affection is flowing to them. It's that we want their affection to flow to us. That I'm giving my affection to them as a way to have me be the center. I'm not really serving them. I'm not really serving my country. I'm not really serving my boss. I'm not really serving my husband or my wife or my children or my mother or my father or my brother or whatever. I really want everyone to serve me. And that's what Srila Prabhupada is talking about in this purport, satisfying our own desires. He says all these other things are just extended sense gratification. They look nice. Oh, I'm taking care of my children. Just see how selfless I am. I'm sacrificing for my wife. Just see how selfless I am. But how do we know we're not really sacrificing for the wife? Because as soon as the wife insults us, we become furious. That means we're really working for ourselves. My purpose in serving my wife was that she would be what I wanted and satisfy my desires. My purpose in serving my husband is so he would satisfy my desires. When he doesn't, I become angry and disgusted. That must be given up because it's false. It is not real. If we say, I want the real, I want the absolute truth, Param Satvam Dhimahi, I want to meditate on the absolute truth. You can't meditate on illusion and the absolute truth at the same time. And then the progress is very slow. We'll say, why is it so slow? Because we're pouring water on it at the same time. But it can look like bhakti. Oh, it can look like bhakti. Oh, well, they're devotees. Therefore, I'm serving the devotees. As Prabhupada says here, service to the devotees is equal to service to the Lord. And can even be greater than a service. Oh, this is my service. The reason I have this attachment is it's my service. So again, the two mistakes, just saying, okay, I just won't have any affection for anybody, which we can't maintain. Or superficially calling it our service, when really what's going on is still just my personal sense gratification. And if we want to know whether it's service or whether it's our sense gratification, we can basically see what makes us angry, what makes us frustrated, what makes us want to give up, what makes us want to walk away, what makes us disgusted. Now, that's our good evidence as to what we're really working for, what's our real center. So what Kunti's begging for is cut that illusion that because I have some bodily relationship with somebody, therefore, if I'm affectionate to that person, I'll get what I need. They'll fulfill me. Cut that insanity. So what does a devotee do instead? The devotee only has affection for Krishna. But then what does Krishna say? Krishna says, serve my devotees. Be kind to all living entities. In fact, over and over again in the Shastra, it says that if one is not kind to all living entities, then one's offering to Krishna is like offering oblations into ashes. There's no effect. One cannot love Krishna without also being kind to all living entities. And one should be kind to all living entities equally, to friends and enemies, to family and not family. Of course, we may have some particular service to family. You know, it's not that a man has to provide a house for everybody in the world. He has to provide a house for his own family members. But that's his service. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Sharanagati explains this so nicely. He says, I'm just serving you, Krishna. And I'm seeing the family members as your maidservants and manservants. Whatever care I take of them is actually service to you. And you're responsible. And the difference is then the devotee's sense of satisfaction comes from Krishna's satisfaction, not from the external results. If one serves one's country, one's boss, one's mother, one's father, one's husband, one's wife, one's children, one's society of devotees. I was reading a little bit of a history yesterday of Prabhupada's relation with the Gaudiya Math and how Srila Prabhupada tried so hard to serve the Gaudiya Math. It didn't work. I mean, some of his godbrothers, obviously, were very affectionate to him and so forth, but Prabhupada had godbrothers who were very envious of him and very critical of him. and took the service he did to Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati and just made it into a disservice. They said, oh, we're not going to eat the food prepared by your disciples because they're all mleches. Of course, they would turn around and ask Prabhupada for money for their temples. And Prabhupada would say, well, I don't want to give you this money because it's money from the mleches, so you'll become polluted. Just like if you eat their food, you'll be polluted. So if you take their money, you'll also be polluted. He says, if you like, you can give management of the temple over to our society, and then we'll immediately spend all the money for the temple's maintenance. So, you know, one can serve the Sangha of devotees and be mystery, whatever the results may not be what one wants. But in Krishna consciousness, that's irrelevant. If one's in Krishna consciousness, what results I get back for me do not disturb me. That in Krishna consciousness means there's no hankering and lamentation, there's no desires and anger for some specific sort of reciprocation or results in the world for me. Whatever the results may be, win or lose the battle, everybody loves me, everybody hates me, everyone appreciates me, no one appreciates me. That's no longer what's driving me. What's driving me is Krishna please? Is Krishna please? Is Guru please? And Krishna and Guru are pleased if I treat people with affection. In fact, there's this word overflow. Right? Udvahatat. Overflow. When one has affection for Krishna, the water, the Ganges water of that affection overflows. So the Ganges always flows to the sea, but the Ganges also floods the land, does it not? The Ganges only goes to the sea. It doesn't go anyplace else. But it floods the land and it fertilizes the land on its way to the sea. It nourishes everyone on its way to the sea. But its goal is the sea. Its goal is the sea. The sea is considered the husband and the rivers the wives. So that's the devotee. The devotee is going only to Krishna. But going to Krishna means overflowing. And in the process of going to Krishna, one gives to everyone else. But one is expecting reciprocation only from Krishna. We give this example so many times. You work for a business. The boss pays a salary. The co-workers do not pay the salary. The customers do not pay the salary. Yes, you try to please the customers. You know, it's considered illegal almost everywhere in the world to ask for a bribe. A bribe means you ask the customer to give you some money directly without going through the company. And Prabhupada compares going to the demigods for fulfillment of material desires. He compares that like trying to bribe the demigods. So having material desires means bribing. Okay, I'm serving you for Krishna, but I want you to give me something too. Krishna doesn't pay me enough money. Krishna's paying me a low salary, so I got to get a bribe from you, or I won't give you my services. And no, the devotee doesn't accept bribes from anyone. And the devotee isn't disappointed. If somebody gives them a bribe, they immediately give it to Krishna. Or they'll say, no, you can't give this to me. You have to give this to Krishna. Okay, I want to give this to you. Okay, here. Krishna, you take this. Not for me. And if someone refuses to give us a bribe, we still serve. Because our check is coming from the boss. We want to please the customers so the boss will be pleased. We want to please the co-workers so the boss will be pleased. We want to please the suppliers so the boss will be pleased. Because only the boss pays our salary. I know you could say this verse as, let me get my payment only from you and let me not take bribes from anyone else. Let me not look for bribes from anyone else. Let me act legitimately. And then we're satisfied because it's the boss who has the unlimited bank account. You know, and if you start taking bribes from the customers, then you stop worrying, you stop thinking about, you stop meditating on what the boss wants. And the customers who are giving you the bribe, or the suppliers giving you the bribe, they'll induce you to do things against the best wishes of the company. And then you start thinking of yourself as the center. This is why bribes are illegal. You start thinking that my pleasure and my money is what's important. And pretty soon the company, if everyone's taking bribes, it will be engaged in illegal business that harms people. And that's the material world. Even though it's really Krishna who's supplying everything, we've got this like underground black market going on, where we're, you know, each bribing each other back and forth and thinking that the others are the demigods or the other, whatever, are the source of our satisfaction, and I'm really the most important, and then it's a catastrophe. And everything becomes spoiled. And Krishna's saying, don't you have faith that I'm going to fulfill your desires? Of course, one may say, well, you know, I'm trying to just please Krishna. I'm trying to just work for Krishna's pleasure. I don't feel Krishna's reciprocation. Or Krishna's reciprocation isn't enough for me. I need this and I need that also. In addition, I need Krishna and. See, Kunti's asking, I don't want Krishna and. I want only Krishna. So Prabhupada says one has to be patient. And one has to look for how Krishna is reciprocating. Frankly, no one else will satisfy us. So to give up the source of our real satisfaction just because we're not fully feeling that yet, and to look for other sources of satisfaction which impede our getting our real satisfaction is really foolish. So Krishna, I don't feel total reciprocation from you yet. I don't feel total satisfaction from you yet. All right, let me find satisfaction from other things on the side. I mean, again, if we think of it with a material example, you know, if you work for a company and they're going to pay you at the end of the month, so until the end of the month comes, you don't have enough money. So you think, well, okay, until the end of the month comes, I'll also work at other jobs. I'll work at this job, I'll work at that job, I'll work at that job. Then you can't give your attention to your main job. Your energy is splayed. And then the boss may fire you. Say, well, I'm not going to have you work here. You're getting all these other jobs. You're coming into work tired. It's like I remember years ago. we had this kid. We used to have a lot of kids staying in our house. Anyway, we had this kid staying in our house, and he would fall asleep standing up. He'd be in the kitchen washing the dishes. He'd fall asleep standing up. And every day in Joppa, he was falling asleep. And one night, 11 o'clock, I woke up in the middle of the night spontaneously and I found him playing computer games. Oh, no wonder you're falling asleep, standing up in the kitchen. So it's like that. You know, so Prabhupada will also give the analogy in relation to this verse, which he gives so many times, about that as soon as there's marriage, there's not immediately a child. It's going to be at least 9 months before there's a child. Of course, modern marriages, people don't seem to want to have children, which is something else. But the wife doesn't say to the husband, you know, it's not on her wedding day. She says, okay, where's my baby? I want my baby today. He says, my dear wife, you know, we can undergo the proper process and I'll do my best to impregnate you, but it'll be at least 9 months before you're holding that baby. And she says, well, what am I going to do for those 9 months before I have that baby? I'm just not satisfied. So while I'm waiting for my baby, I'm going to have to do other things. I'm going to have to go be with other men, or I'm going to have to kidnap somebody else's baby or something like that. You know, then he's going to say, well, where's your relationship with me? So perhaps this is one of the most difficult things of being a devotee, is to say, I am only going to take reciprocation from Krishna. I am going to serve others as if I were an ordinary person. Prabhupada says here, Arjuna is the same Arjuna. I'm going to go about my business externally. It may look as if I'm doing ordinary things in the world and working at a job and taking care of a family and going to school and so many things. But I'm going to wait for Krishna's paycheck. I am not going to take bribes. I'm not going to be angry if I don't get a bribe. I'm not going to ask for bribes, and I'm not going to accept a bribe. I'm only going to accept my paycheck from Krishna. And I'm going to be serving everyone else to please Krishna, not independently. As Prabhupada says so nicely, that we should only dance with Krishna, not dance alone, and not dance with anybody else. And be patient for Krishna's paycheck. And frankly, if Krishna sees us taking bribes, then it's going to take a long time. You know, and this impatience comes from thinking that I'm not at fault. That the moment I say to Krishna, okay, Krishna, now I'm going to serve you, that Krishna should immediately give me the whole spiritual world on a platter. And not seeing that I'm in material consciousness because I'm an offender. And it may take Krishna some time to trust me. And why should Krishna trust me if as soon as I don't get reciprocation from him, I go looking for reciprocation from somebody else? Then he's not going to trust me. He'll say, okay, you know, when you really get to the point that you're just waiting for reciprocation from me. And what's ironic, of course, is that when one does that, one's desires in relationship to other living entities are also satisfied. That's what's ironic. That when one is a pure devotee and one feels satisfied. Prabhupada says one feels that one's in the spiritual world. It doesn't matter if one's god brothers are criticizing you. It doesn't matter if your wife, you know, never cooks you a meal. It doesn't matter. You're feeling yourself in the spiritual world and you're feeling actual love and actual happiness for all living entities. So it's really, Prabhupada will say in other places, a very small change. That the person I'm trying to satisfy is Krishna, only Krishna. I'm only going to the sea. On the way, I may flood the land and fertilize the land. On the way, I am serving so many living entities as part of my service to Krishna, to please Krishna, for the paycheck from Krishna, for Krishna to smile. Just like a practical way of thinking about this is in most temples, they read the book distribution scores to the deities, to Srila Prabhupada. Why? So that the book distributors realize I'm distributing these books for Guru and Krishna's pleasure, not for the accolades of the other devotees. Of course, we give them accolades. But if one is doing it for the accolades from the other devotees, separate from Krishna, one will become disgusted after some time. So this applies, you know, also to those who have no family, to those who are living in an ashram, to those who have, you know, so-called renounced the world, or actually renounced the world. Who am I really trying to please? Am I trying to please my institution, my whatever, separate from Krishna? So I know of one devotee who shows everything to her deities. If ever somebody sends her a letter, she reads a letter to her deities. If she, when she writes a reply, she reads her reply to her deities. All of her, the money that comes in and out. So all of the, she reads the expense report to the deities. When money comes in cash or check, of course now a lot of money comes in electronically, it's kind of hard to do this, but money comes in with cash or check, she puts that money on her altar in front of her deities. This is for you. Whatever expenditures, she reads that to the deities. This is the expenditure. And one can do that with one's relationship too. One can go every day and go and make a report to the deities. Have a picture of Krishna. My dear Lord, this is how I treated my mother today. This is how I treated my brother today. This is how I treated my sister today. So in this way, we have that Krishna is the center. My dear Lord, I took care of my daughter like this today. This is my report. Just like in a company, one may make a report, you know, when you call a company and you talk to the customer service representative, there's usually this thing that says, this call may be recorded for quality assurance. So think like that. All my conversations, all my actions, they're being recorded, because they are. and they're being reviewed by Krishna. That Krishna is my source of satisfaction. So this is such a beautiful prayer by Kunti. And this is the essence of Krishna consciousness. Krishna, you are everything. What's that bird? What is that bird that only gets water from the clouds? What's the name of that bird? Chicory bird. I always want to call it a kachori. That's a food. So the whatever it is, bird. It's not a kachori bird. Anyway, it only gets water from the clouds. It doesn't take water from any other source. So we only get our satisfaction from Krishna. And when we only get our satisfaction from Krishna, then we become perfect friends and lovers and well-wishers of all living entities without selfish motive. So questions, comments, etc. Went a little longer today.
Might be just sentimental emotions of a woman. Women, I think, have more of a tendency to have sentimentality and emotional feelings and responses to others. And how can we say or prove that this is pure devotion to the Lord and not just womanly bodily sentimentality?
Well, I suppose for that one has to trust the Bhagavatam. Kaitava Dharma, Projita. All cheating religion is thrown out of the Bhagavatam. So, for that we have to trust the Bhagavatam. We have to trust that the Bhagavatam says at the beginning that Kaitava Dharma, or cheating religion, is thrown out. There's no cheating religion in the Bhagavatam. There's no gyan-covered bhakti or karma-covered bhakti in the Bhagavatam. There's no sentimentality. And we have to see the acceptance of the other sadhus. So the other any sadhu, any acharya who reads the Bhagavatam, they will say that these prayers of Kunti are expressing the highest perfection of life, that she's a pure devotee of the Lord. So, and that, I mean, it's in the Bhagavatam. So if one doesn't accept the Bhagavatam as what the Bhagavatam says it is, then what can you do? So it's like a dictionary. How do we know this is the right definition? Well, it's in the dictionary. If you don't accept the dictionary as authoritative, what is there to say? You know, when we teach logic, one of the things we teach is never argue about something when you can look it up. When you can look it up in an authoritative source, then immediately stop the argument and go look it up. Now, the only thing you can argue about then is this an authoritative source? So if we're arguing about, you know, the capital of a country, and I go to an encyclopedia and look it up, and then you can say, well, that's not a bona fide encyclopedia. You know, so you could argue, is the Bhagavatam bona fide? But once you accept that the Bhagavatam is bona fide, then there's no question of is Kunti actually a saintly person.
Thank you very much. Very good.
Paribol, Mother Urmila, this is Mahesh. Thank you for your class. You know, these days we are celebrating Navaratri, which is the worship of, I guess, offering respects to the grandmother, the great mother, or the mother of the universe, Durga, Lakshmi, Saraswati. So you are saying that, well, we should bypass this worship and just focus on Krishna, but don't you think that would be disrespectful if we don't actually offer our respects to the demigods somehow?
Well, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu offered respects to demigods when he was on tour of South India, he would go to temples of Durga and he would go to temples of Shiva and so forth and offer respects, as did Lord Balaram when he was touring. So certainly we can offer respects. And Nanda Maharaj and the residents of Vrindavan, it said they sometimes observed Shivaratri. It wasn't a regular thing. But so for the devotees, this is not a regular part of our practice. We don't regularly engage in worship of the demigods. However, there's no problem with respecting the demigods. We want to respect every living entity, what to speak of the demigods. But when we respect the demigods, it should be to please Krishna. Again, this company analogy. Every jiva is either a co-worker in our company of love of God, a customer in our company, or a potential customer, or a supplier of love of God. So the demigods, you know, many of them are co-workers, and many of them are suppliers. So one can certainly worship Durga as Vaishnavi, as the sister of Vishnu. But it depends why one is worshiping. Just like the gopis, they worship Durga Devi so they could marry Krishna. And generally, Srila Prabhupada discouraged us from doing any kind of demigod worship because the tendency when doing any sort of demigod worship is to be material. Just like Prabhupada explains with the marriage of Rukmini, that he said that she went to this temple of Durga to worship Durga before the wedding. And Prabhupada said that the Kshatriyas at that time, many times they would worship both the power and the powerful. He said they were worshiping Vishnu, they were worshiping Narayan, but they were worshiping Vishnu or Narayan for spiritual purposes, and then they think, okay, but for material benediction, I have to worship Durga Devi. So it depends on your mentality. If you're, you know, like Shiva is the head of a sampradaya, Brahma is the head of a sampradaya, Lakshmi Devi is the head of a sampradaya, the Four Kumaras is the head of a sampradaya. We worship Guru. Guru is also a jiva. In fact, Prabhupada says spiritual master is not a particular person. He says spiritual master is a truth. But at least us ostensibly, externally, we have a particular jiva who's guru, and we're offering worship to that jiva. Just like Prabhupada says here in this purport, that he says service to the Lord and service of the devotees are identical. Sometimes service to the devotee is more valuable than service to the Lord. So if you're serving a demigod as a devotee to please Krishna, that's fine. It's the same with, you know, it's the same principle as taking care of your child or being nice to your boss at work. It's the same principle. Are you seeing Jivara Swarupaya Krishna or Nityadasha? Everyone is a servant of Krishna. In order to please my boss, I'm serving the servants. Or are you thinking, I'm serving them to get something for myself? But definitely the traditional Vaishnavas, they do not observe the demigod festivals as a regular occurrence or as something that's required. So it's not required, and it doesn't have to be regular. But if one does it in the proper consciousness, then there's no harm, and there's plenty of precedent for great devotees, even God himself, doing that in the proper consciousness. So that really depends. And one thing that we wouldn't want to do is we wouldn't want to have official temples where there's regular worship of the demigods going on. And, you know, again, unless it's done in a very particular way. So this is engendered some controversy. One controversy that we were involved in on the Shastric Advisory Council, I don't think we ever actually published a paper on it, at least there's no paper anywhere on it, was that in Mayapur Dham, the devotees wanted to establish some sort of worship place on each of the 9 islands. And at Simantadweep, I think it's called, that's where Durga Devi is meditating on Lord Chaitanya. It's where Parvati in the Simha, that's the border, and so in the part of her hair, something has to do something with the part of her hair, I don't remember the exact story. But so the devotees there wanted to install a deity of Parvati, of Durga Devi, there in Simantadweep, which is right by where our Jagannath temple is. And there was a big controversy as to whether or not we could install deities of a demigod. So our conclusion as the Sastric Advisory Council was the deity could be installed if the deity was given the remnants from the worship of Jagannath or from the worship of Lord Chaitanya. So the deity wasn't offered things directly. The deity would be given the prasadam. And also if the deity's form was made in such a way that it was obvious to anybody who came that Parvati is a servant of Lord Chaitanya. So under those conditions, we agreed to the installation of the deity. I mean, in our farm in Hungary, there's a small temple to Lord Shiva and a small temple to Yogamaya that are outside of the main temple. And the remnants from Radhasham are brought out to Lord Shiva and to Yogamaya. Also, both in Hungary and in Bhaktivedanta Manor, we have deities of Vrindadevi. And again, the Mahaprasadam of the deities are brought out to Vrindadevi. So these things can be done with great care. They don't have to be done. We don't have to have a deity of Vrindadevi. We don't have to have a deity of Durga Devi or Lord Shiva or any of these personalities. That's not at all required. If somebody wants to do that for some purpose, then it has to be. There has to be a very clear purpose, and it has to be done in such a way that we understand that there's only one God, that there's not more than one God, where we're not trying to bribe the demigods, nor are we looking for them to pay us a bribe.
Mother Urmila, what do you think of the Ganesh deity that's outside of the Honolulu Temple?
I don't think it's my position as just a member of the Hare Krishna movement to talk about a specific instance like that. I mean, the only reason I'm talking about the specific instance of the deity in Mayapur is that the GBC asked me, as one of the members of the Shastric Advisory Council, to make a decision on that case. And as a group of devotees with extensive consultation of the Shastras, we came to a decision. So therefore, I can speak about that particular deity, and I can say the principles that the Shastric Advisory Council decided on. It is not within the range of my service to decide how to apply those particular principles to another specific case. That's the business of the GBC and the managers of that temple. So the kind of principles that Prabhupada gave us, I mean, Prabhupada gave us principles that any murti should not be outside exposed to the elements. Like in Detroit, we had murtis of the avatars, but they were all in a covered gazebo type thing. Prabhupada didn't want there to be, he didn't even want there to be like a flag with a picture of Lord Chaitanya outside where it could be, you know, snowed on and rained on. And Prabhupada would talk about the statues to famous politicians where the birds pass stool on the statue and then the government cleans them off with a municipal brush, and that's their worship. Srila Prabhupada did not want us to have murtis like that. So that's one general principle, that the demigods are great personalities. They are devotees, and some of them are pure devotees. So whenever we have their murti, it should be in some situation where there's respect. The same in our home, even with pictures. I was told, I don't know if it's true, but it seems reasonable to me, that Srila Prabhupada didn't like unframed pictures on walls. He didn't consider it respectful. So even when we have pictures, I mean, I was visiting one devotee's house where they had a picture. It wasn't a frame, but it was just kind of lying somewhere, and it was so dirty, it was black. So there has to be some respect. Or one time there was a temple that painted the Hare Krishna mantra on the steps, on the vertical part of the steps. Prabhupada wouldn't enter the temple until it was painted over. So Prabhupada says the name written in letters is also Krishna. So where we display the mantra, where we display pictures of Krishna, or where we display the demigods, it should be done in a way that is respectful and then any of these forms should be, they should be taken care of, and they should be taken care of in such a way that it's clear that they are not God. So those are the basic principles, and then it's up to the individual temple presidents and the individual GBC to take those principles and apply it to specific situations. And, you know, obviously in our own home it's a little different, but even then we should have these principles, that any depiction of Krishna or his devotees should be treated with respect, should be kept in such a way that engenders our respect, and then should be treated in a way where Krishna is the Supreme Lord, that we never equate the jiva or any demigod, even Shiva, who's not a jiva, that we never equate them with God, that we worship them as servants of God. If we worship them as servants of God, they will be pleased, and Krishna will be pleased. If we worship them on an equal level with God, Krishna will not be pleased, and they will not be pleased. If you work in a company, and someone tries to give you a bribe, and you're an honest employee, you'll not be pleased either. You know, the head of the company won't be pleased, and you'll be also displeased. So those are the principles, and for a specific, unless the temple president or GBC asks me about specific instances, it's not my business to apply the principles to those instances. That's their business.
Just an interesting footnote to that, that I can appreciate Ramananda's question, and I also appreciate that it's not our position to address it. But there's an interesting footnote that Mother Mother, the class that you addressed that came a couple of weeks ago when you were here, a lot of the students sent me questions afterwards as they were preparing their papers. One of the questions was, what was the form that was in front of the temple? And why was there money placed before it? So I had to, you know, deal with that in a real respectful way. But anyway, just a little note on that.
Yeah, well, sometimes we're put in a position, and I'm not making any judgment on that particular Ganesh, good or bad at all. I'm not. But as a principle, sometimes each of us is put in a position where, whether it's, you know, with our family, with our job, with our country, or with our local temple, or with our international sangha, where someone asks us to explain something with which we disagree. And that is just life. It's just simply part of life. You know, that we're each, unless we're completely separate from society in general, we're all part of something. Everyone's part of a family, unless their mother and father are dead and they have no brothers and sisters and all their aunts and uncles and grandparents are all dead. Everyone's part of a family. Everyone's part of a community. Everyone's part of a country. Most people are part of some sort of an employer. If we're interested in spiritual life, we're part of some sort of a sangha, some sort of a group of practitioners, and we have our local group, and then we may have our national or international group, and it is guaranteed that some other members of the groups to which we belong, I'll give you a guarantee, that they will do things with which we disagree, sometimes vehemently disagree. Of course, that means that we also will sometimes do things with which the other members of our group disagree as well, and other people in our group may have to scurry around to defend our actions. That may also happen. And we should assume that it is happening. We should assume that behind our backs that somebody is having to explain away and justify behavior of ours with which they do not agree. So we cannot expect that we are all going to agree on how everyone else in the groups to which we belong behaves or thinks. That will not happen. That will not happen. Frankly, even among pure devotees, Rupa Goswami explains in his Ujjwala Nilamani how Radharani and Chandravali don't agree with how the other one treats Krishna. You know, that Radharani will say that Chandravali, she doesn't know how to please Krishna. And Chandravali says that Radharani, she doesn't know how to please Krishna. So, of course, they're cousin sisters, and they love each other, and they're both dancing in Rasalila with Krishna. But they have their differences of opinions about how to please Krishna. And that's what it is. That's what it means to be an individual. Prabhupada talks about different political parties, but they both have their view to serve the country. So here in America, we have our two main parties and some minor parties. And the Democrats want to please the country in one way, and the Republicans want to serve the country in another way. And even if you're a Democrat and you think the Republicans are crazy, I have one friend that will go on and on and on about what's wrong with the Republican Party. But can you say the Republican Party doesn't want to serve the country? Of course they want to serve the country. So therefore we can have unity and diversity. That we're all trying to please Krishna. We're all attempting to be that Ganges flowing to the sea. We may fail, we may get diverted, we may have so many deficiencies, but that's our attempt. Our attempt is to be that Ganges flowing to the sea. So there may be differences because people are making actual mistakes, but then I make so many mistakes, what can I say? And there may be differences because it's on a transcendental platform. And I'm pleasing Krishna in one way and you're pleasing Krishna in another way. Here in Hawaii, so many rivers are flowing to the sea. And one is flowing on the eastern side of the island and one is flowing on the western side of the island. They may appear to be flowing in opposite directions. One is flowing west to east and one is flowing east to west. But actually they're all flowing into the sea. So we should see with the other devotees that they are trying to please Krishna. Maybe they're making some mistake in the process, in which case we see, is it my business to rectify it or not? To make an attempt to rectify through the proper channels, if it's my business. And we may see that one river is flowing west to east and one is flowing east to west, but if they're all flowing into the sea, then these are on another platform. Like Prabhupada told the devotees not to visit Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's brother, Lalit Prasad. He said he has some serious difference of opinion with Bhaktisiddhanta. He said, this difference is spiritual, but you will see it as material. So it's better that you avoid seeing him because then you'll just commit offenses. So sometimes that is also true, that even within our group of devotees, people are serving in different ways. But even among the non-devotees, Jivara Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasha, that of course we try to preach and we try to elevate persons, but we also see that everything is perfectly arranged by Krishna. Okay, I think we can take one more and then we really should stop.
Hare Krishna, Mother Amala. This is Balabhadra Das. You spoke in the earlier part of your talk about affection for family and, I was just thinking, like, in the Bhagavatam, we have the example of Bharata Maharaj, how he renounced everything. But then he fell victim to having an affection for a deer. How do we understand that?
Well, the Acharyas explain it in different ways. Some of them explain that Bharata Maharaj was fully liberated and he was acting this way as part of Krishna's plan simply to set an example, like Bhishma fighting on the side of the Kurus, or like Maharaj Parikit becoming angry at Shamakarishi. That this, some of the Acharyas explain like that, that Bharata Maharaj's behavior was a kind of lila. Srila Prabhupada also, and sometimes Prabhupada will also explain it like that. And additionally, Srila Prabhupada explained, if you look at the very, very end of that pastime, the end of the conversation between Jed Bharata and Maharaj Rahugana, right as Jed Bharata is leaving, there's a purport there where Prabhupada says that the reason this happened to Bharata Maharaj is that when the mother deer died, when the baby deer was orphaned, that he did not take the matter for consultation to his guru. He was living in Pulaha Ashram. He was living in the ashram of Pulaha Muni. But he just decided how to deal with it himself instead of consulting with higher authorities. And for this reason, basically he fell down because of disrespect to his guru. And Prabhupada explains it like that. So you know, you can.
Someone whose character shows such disrespect.
To think about it the way you said it.
Well, another thing to consider is that Bharat Maharaj had been a kshatriya. And a kshatriya's job is to protect all of the citizens, all of the praja. The upadhi, the abhiman of the kshatriya is, I am a super father. I am the ultra father, the ultra husband. I am the word husband means to take care of, like you can husband a flock of sheep. You're taking care of them. So that's the mood of the king. The king has to make sure that everyone is protected. And this Ishwara Bhav, this mood of being the controller, Prabhupada says this is a mood of protection, that I am the protector. So kshatriya has this mood. And it's interesting with Lord Ramachandra. When Lord Ramachandra went into the forest, the sages asked him, please protect us from the demons. And he said, yes, I take a vow that I will protect you. So afterwards, in Valmiki's Ramayana, there's a discussion between Sita and Ram, and Sita said, I don't think you did the right thing by taking this vow. You're not right now acting as a kshatriya, you're acting as an ascetic in the forest. You've renounced everything. Why are you in this mood of protecting the sages? You should be detached from this. And Ram said, no, I'm not actually taking a vow of renunciation like Vanaprastha at the end of life. You know, I'm in exile as a so-called punishment, but I still have this duty as a kshatriya. I'm here as the ambassador of Bharat, who's on the throne. Or it can also be understood that Bharat never really became the king, that really Ram was king in absentia, and his shoes were on the throne. Anyway, my point is that Ramchandra explained to Sita that he was still in the mood of a kshatriya, that he wasn't there he wasn't in the forest for renunciation. Now, Bharat did go to the forest for renunciation. His idea was not just giving up family life, but he was also giving up his varna. Varna activities are only done in the grihastha ashram. Varna activities are not done in the vanaprastha or sannyas ashram. But it's not so astonishing that he fell into this upadhi, this designation that I'm the protector, that I'm the caretaker. That really isn't such an astonishing thing, and that he didn't think to ask anybody, that it was sort of an automatic response. It's not such an unusual thing at all. You know, this was the reason, of course, why the kings in Vedic times, they didn't serve until death for their own sake, and they left that when they would abdicate, they would leave the kingdom. You know, if you have the abdicated king sitting around while his son is on the throne, he's going to still try to run everything. That's just natural. You know, if a person's been CEO of a company and then he retires, he doesn't still come to the office. You know, he may be a consultant from a distance, you know, but he's not going to still come to the office, because then he's just going to make a problem. So the idea was that the kings would go to the forest so that they could forget, you know, what's there to manage in the forest? Nothing. What's there to protect in the forest? Nothing. You just engage in meditation. And somehow or other, there was a situation right in front of his face where this prematurely born baby deer was in dire need of protection. It was born prematurely and its mother died. And this natural protective instinct of the king was there. So I don't think it's so astonishing. You know, and there's a pure devotee has affection for all living entities and wants to take care of all living entities. The mistake that the mistakes, shall we say, that Bharat Maharaj made was, first of all, that wasn't his duty any longer. That was no longer his service. And if he still felt some concern, he needed to consult. He couldn't just act instinctively as a Kshatriya anymore. And the other mistake he made was that he wasn't doing it, which is very related, of course, is that he stopped doing it as a service. He started doing it again as a bribe, that, oh, this deer is meant to satisfy me. I'm satisfying this deer independently. But it's not such an astonishing mistake for a king, for an emperor, to make. It's rather understandable that there would be a long ingrained habit, and his spiritual life was not fully perfect. It was almost perfect, but it wasn't fully perfect. So he had to still have some care there. But, you know, it was a very brief detour. And in the scope of universal time, it wasn't that meaningful. And he very quickly rectified his mistake. In the body of a deer, he engaged in spiritual life. He stayed at the ashram of sages and so forth. And then in the last life, he said, I'm not getting involved in anything in this world. I'm not going to have any upadis at all. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.